All right, I'm going to call this meeting of the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum. I'm sure many members will be ushering themselves in the next couple of minutes. Quorum is present. So let's see. Representative Frederick, would you like to move the minutes for April 8th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any corrections before I move to approval of the minutes? Not seeing any. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Our first bill today is from Representative Vang. If you want to make your way up there. Representative Vang, I assume you would like to move House File 858 before the committee.
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Vang, it's your bill.
All right. Let me just grab my notes here. So a little bit background about the bio incentive program. It was established in 2015 to encourage commercial sale production of advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and biomass thermal energy through production incentive payments. The bio incentive program sunset in 2025. Eligible producers or facilities can enter the program until of June last year. Once a producer...
Representative Vang, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Could you move the mic just yet? Okay. A little closer.
Right? All right.
Thank you.
My apologies. Once a producer enters the program, they are eligible to receive claim reimbursement payments for 10 years. The bill, House File 858, requires MDA to collect information from program participants every year they receive a claim reimbursement. As of February 2025, there are about 14 producers participating in the bio incentive programs. For this bill, for the program requirements to receive the payments, the production facilities within Minnesota must begin producing biofuels, renewable chemicals, or biomass thermal energy before June 30th, 2025, meet quarterly minimum production levels, use biomass from agricultural or forestry sources or the organic portion of solid waste, and source 80% of renewable biomass from Minnesota, and harvest agricultural and forestry biomass in ways that do not harm the environment. And they can receive payments for up to 10 years on a first-come, first-served basis while funding lasts. And starting in 2019, the program has regularly expended all of its annual funding. And so in 2024, there was a legislative audit conducted by the OLA. It focused on MDA's internal controls and adherence to legal requirements, not so much on the validity of the program or if it was working as intended. The LA did come up with two recommendations: that the department should require that grantees submit progress reports annually, and that the reports include sufficient details on project progress. And then suggest that the department should not make payments to grantees with past two progress reports. And so per following up the OLL's recommendation, House File 85 includes a robust new list of reporting requirements that program participants or producers must provide before receiving payments. And in the bill, it lists about 10 items. One is the producer's business structure, the name and address of the producer's parent company, a list of financial assistance received, goals for a number of jobs created and progress in achieving those goals, and including equity hiring goals as well, wage goals and progress in achieving goals for jobs created or maintained by the producer, board member, executive compensation, evidence of compliance with environmental permits, the producer's intended and actual use of payments received from the commissioner, and if applicable, a latest financial audit opinion statement produced by a certified public accountant. And so it's a pretty, it does what the OLA recommends, but also does a little bit more to continue on with like the transparency of knowing where our public dollars are being spent or if it's been well utilized. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take any questions.
Before we move to questions, we're going to see if we have any testifiers in the audience. I have one down here, Brian Werner. Are you in attendance? Mr. Werner, when you're ready, please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Chair Smith and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Werner, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association, or MBA. Several members of MBA are participants in the bioincentive program and would be directly impacted by House File 858. One kernel of corn produces, on average, 2.9 gallons of fuel, 14 pounds of dried distiller's grains animal feed, and 1 pound of corn oil. Many ethanol biorefineries have also begun producing an additional co-product called corn kernel fiber ethanol, which is fermented from the non-edible fiber in the corn kernel rather than the sugars and starch. As an advanced cellulosic biofuel, it reduces life cycle greenhouse gas emissions by over 70% as compared to gasoline and is eligible for reimbursement through the bioincentive program. We agree that strong transparency and reporting requirements for participation in state government programs are key to ensuring accountability in the use of taxpayer funds. However, we have several concerns with these proposed reporting requirements. They go well beyond what is necessary to evaluate the program's effectiveness. They will add administrative costs to biorefineries and the Department of Agriculture, and they could undermine the intent of the program, which is to attract economic development that benefits local agricultural producers. It's also important to note that in August of 2024, this program underwent a rigorous performance and financial audit from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. The final report came back without written findings, and the deputy auditor said at a February 2025 hearing in this committee, quote, "For the incentive program, we really didn't find any findings. It was operating well," end quote. Again, we support enhanced transparency in reporting and would be happy to work with the author and the committee on a more effective approach that produces improved accountability and program outcomes without increasing bureaucracy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Werner. Is there anyone from the public who's here that would like to testify that was not pre-registered to do so? Does not look like it. So we'll move to member questions. Any member questions? I will say, members, I believe we heard a report about this OLA, correct me if I'm wrong, Chair Anderson, last session in 2025. So we have heard about this before. I'm not seeing any other questions. Chair Anderson, would you like to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Vang, this program has been around a while. We just heard testimony that the program is working well, making progress, it's effective, and just wondering why at this kind of late stage of the ballgame you're coming with this bill that requires additional layers of compliance and such, getting into private businesses' pay, for example, and equity-based hiring, diversity. Why are we doing it at this stage,
Chair? Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as we, you know, a lot of been talking about politics right now in terms of accountability and transparency. This is not to suggest that the producers are I guess, not doing or not are misusing public dollars, but really there is really not a lot of requirements right now, especially with the when we look at nonprofits and how much we scrutinize them for making sure they turn in their grant reportings on time, and yet for public dollars to private entities like the bioincentive program, there's not much reporting requirements involved. And so I think just leveling the consistency of reporting requirements and making sure that we are aware of whether the program is doing well. I think the OLA recommendations or the audit didn't really do so much in terms of measuring the success or the effectiveness of the program. It did more so on the it focused more so on how MDA is administering the program, and I think that's the difference in the OLA's audit. And so I think this is a way for us to help us as legislators evaluate the effectiveness of the program too as well.
Chair Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Well, your bill number is pretty low, 858. We're past deadline. What's the path forward for this bill?
Representative Vang.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, well, I think you and I have been here in the legislature long enough to know there are multiple ways to get a bill enacted into law, not just going through the committee process. And so I think, this is one way, even though it's usually we will prefer bills go through the committee process, there are also ways that we can try to reach an agreement, if there is agreement, to further pass bills.
And I might interject to say, I don't know if I was clear at the beginning, so this is being laid over today. So we're not voting it out of committee. So that's the destination currently in front of us. Chair Anderson.
Oh, just final comments. I think we heard this at a hearing last week, too, in environment. This bill appears to be a solution in search of a problem. I just don't see the problem here with the program as it's going. It's not funded well enough, I'll say that, but it's done its required work of encouraging biomass production in the state, and I support the program, but I do not support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I might take a moment as a chair to say a big emphasis of our entire session has been making sure that public money is used as well as possible. And we're thankful the OLA report on this particular program came back positively. But going forward, I think we need to scrutinize every dollar that we go through this committee. And specifically, one of the things mentioned is goals for the number of jobs created and progress in achieving these goals, which is something I think we want all of our public programs to be able to show us. So I see this as supporting the program to continue to report on its positive gains. But Representative Vang, we'll let you close off this hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to thank the committee for their time in hearing this bill. This is not the first time that this bill has been in front of the Ag Committee, and I think this could be a further conversation as we continue to discuss the end of session. Thank you for your time and support.
Excellent. Representative Vang renews her motion that House File 858 be laid over, and the bill is indeed laid over. Thank you. All right, now it's time for the big event, presentation of the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. We have many members from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture here today, including Deputy Commissioner Vauble, who I see is making her way up. Commissioner Vauble, and maybe Ms. Medina, if you could identify yourself for the record, and then when we have technology on our side, go ahead and get started.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Andrea Vauble. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Michelle Medina. I serve as Director of Government Relations for the Department of Agriculture.
So we are here to go over the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. You will notice that there is a theme here that all of it is budget neutral. So this bill does not have any cost to it, but it also does actually have some efficiencies and savings, which we'll go over. I will try not to go as quickly as I usually do, but please let me know if I'm going too fast. So the first one, it's our Rural Finance Authority Agroforestry Loan Program. Again, it's budget neutral. It expands the practices that Minnesota farmers can finance through our Agroforestry Loan Program. This program has been very lightly used and requires updates to better align with practices that are becoming more commonplace since its inception of this particular program in the year 2000. Includes agroforestry crops and then agroforestry systems such as silvopasture and alley systems. The next one is our seed potato statute changes. This committee has heard about the seed potato statute changes over the last few years. We're happy to have some inclusion in this bill this year. Again, budget neutral and is supported by the growers that we've worked very hard over the last year or two with Representative Burkle and others to get to this point. It updates the seed potato certification process and enforcement requirements, makes definition and procedures clearer, and removes obsolete references. moves penalties and enforcement to Minnesota Statute 18J to align with other plant protection programs and permits the use of agency general funds to support program if needed. One of the things that it does is it allows the seed potato growers to print their own certification tags, where we will see some efficiencies there. Allowing growers to print their own tags could result in a small revenue loss for us at MDA of about approximately $10,000, but we would be offset by the same amount due to reduced labor and supply costs. The next one is our industrial hemp statute changes. Again, budget neutral. This updates our Minnesota Statute 18K, the Industrial Hemp Development Act. It aligns our statute with the state hemp plan that we filed with USDA and has been approved, and it creates one license for both growing and processing raw industrial hemp. It also is in line with the creation of the Office of Cannabis Management, or OCM. So it makes us Farm Bill compliant. So this just gets us into alignment with the hemp plan that we have filed with the federal government. Ag marketing report efficiency proposal. So we have a series of legislative reports that are required as part of our Agri grant program. So we're reporting just for efficiency's sake to combine the separate Agri legislative reports into one annual report for our Food Retail Improvement and Development Grants Program, or FRIDGE, used to be called the Good Food Access Program, the bioincentive program we just discussed, as well as our biofuels infrastructure financial assistance program. We also suggest reducing the dairy development and profitability enhancement report from annual to biannual.
Commissioner, can I ask a quick clarifying question on that? In the combination of those reports, does the content of those reports change at all, or is it simply just one single report?
Mr. Chair, it does not change the content at all. It just combines it into one report.
Okay, just wanted to clarify. Please continue.
The next one is an appropriations technical change, again, budget neutral. We just are aligning our prior appropriations with our agency current organizational structure and operations, specifically for our Emerging Farmers Office, which has been moved into our Ag Marketing and Development Division, and our Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response, which has been moved into our Food and Feed Safety Division. The next two are some items that were in our policy bill originally, but we've, due to the guidance of this committee, have moved over to our finance bill. The special event food stands includes technical clarifications, again, to clarify some of the major legislative changes we made to our licensing structure last year. Again, it's a flat fee of $75 and can only operate for a total of 10 days within their license period. This is for the special event food license. The next one is updates to our retail food delegation. Again, this was also in our policy bill and was moved to our budget bill. Eliminates unnecessary transition language from our original statute, clarifies conformance with our 28A modifications, including a small business extension, and clarifies our conditions for approval of new delegation agreements and retains all of our current delegation agreements as we have right now. So that is what is in the governor's supplemental budget bill this year. A couple of things just on the note you'll see on the governor's page released by MMB. We do include some other things that affect agriculture that will run through other grant or other committee program or committee jurisdiction, including our sustainable aviation fuel tax credit, which runs through the tax committee, and then our bonding request that we've discussed in this committee prior, which is our RFA bonding authority, as well as our East Grand Forks facility. And Mr. Chair. Tried to go through it quickly, so happy to answer any questions.
Impressively quick, yes. Let's move to questions from the committee. Any committee members want to ask a question of the commissioner? We'll go to Chair Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner Vobel, I didn't hear anything about cottage foods. Is that an omission, or is it correct?
Commissioner Vobel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, you are correct. No mention of cottage food specifically.
Okay.
Chair Anderson?
It must have been worked on well last year, and people are satisfied. This is kind of late. Reason for that, I know it's budget neutral, but again, what do you hope is the path forward?
Commissioner Babel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yeah, our hope is that it will move forward onto the floor or be as part of an omnibus bill. We know we're going to be hearing it in the Senate as well, so it is a little bit late in the process, but we are hoping to make it through deadline.
All right. It doesn't look like we have any more questions. That was record time. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
So our next bill is with Chair Hansen, who is currently in Environment, presenting another bill. So we're going to take a brief recess, and when he's back, we will come together again. So for the moment, we're in recess. I'm not that Machiavellian. All right, everyone, we're going to gavel in here in a moment. I'm going to reconvene this meeting of the House Agriculture Committee. And we're going to go to Representative Lawrence, who I apologize I missed before we went to break, wanted to make a quick announcement. And then I've heard Chair Hansen should be here momentarily, and we'll move to House File 2577. But Representative Lawrence.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I just want to make quick announcements. I don't know if you've seen out in the front of the Capitol, but we have the Propane Association out there today, an industry that agriculture depends a lot on as well. But they've gone to a lot of work to put up a nice display and promote the different uses of propane. So if we have a chance after committee, encourage each of the members and the guests to stop by, say hi, and ask some questions along the way. But that was my announcement for today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lawrence. I'm going to talk here momentarily while whispering is happening, but we are going to move to House File 2577, which is a bill chief authored by Chair Hansen. Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill? And of course, get comfortable first. This is your committee, after all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I had to check with the other Mr. Chair on what I was going to do here. So we're on 2577, so I'd move House File 2577 to bring it before the committee.
Chair Hansen has moved House File 2577 before the committee. Chair Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2577 was before the committee a year ago. Not much has changed, except more states and other places have discovered the challenge relating to PFAS in sewage sludge and the application of sewage sludge for fertilizer. So this bill, which we debated extensively last year, has these same issues of defining some of the criteria with sewage sludge, allowing the Department of Agriculture to review records on sewage sludge transactions to help investigate where PFAS may occur, records retention, and then also determines that open burning of fertilizer has an unreasonable adverse effect on the environment and prohibits that. It also prohibits the application of animal waste and sewage sludge, so that's application, not a spill, to impervious surfaces, streets, parking lots, driveways, and mandates that containment when it's on an impervious surface. So that is House File 2577. Members, we discussed that. I think I'm gonna just go with a couple comments before I open up for questions. Members, where we're kind of at with negotiations is the House Democrats have indicated that a high priority for us is the banning of paraquat, and that we are not very supportive of anything else moving forward unless that bill moves forward. And so House File 2577, we're laying over. I'm not asking for a vote on that. We've debated this in the past. This issue was important a year ago. It's important today, and it'll be important a year from now. If things aren't moving, I don't want to force a vote on House File 2577 or the subsequent bill, which I will introduce. So,
thank you for that introduction, Chair Hansen. I'm going to quickly check if there's anyone in the audience that would like to testify specifically on House File 2577. Doesn't look to be the case, and so we will move on to questions from members. Any member questions? It's a very quiet committee today. Chair Anderson, go ahead.
We have to have some talking. thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Hansen, we've been at national ag conferences in the past. This was a real issue, I believe, at a dairy farm, Vermont, New Hampshire. And so is your language somewhat similar to that which was enacted in that state as well?
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Anderson. It's similar, but it what they're trying to grapple with in the Northeast, and I think they're trying to get this federally, is some type of compensation for the farmer because the land may not be able to be sold. And so I know they've been struggling with that, but trying to find some way of at least tracking where these applications were, because in many cases, I'll use the Northeast because that has been reported. Maybe it was applied by somebody's grandfather accepted the waste. Yeah. So how many years, but then somebody buys the property and they didn't know that it was there. So I think the records retention is really important, at least from this point on. And I think they're still grappling with that in the Northeast.
No further questions. Doesn't look like there are any other questions from committee members. So, Chair Hansen, I'm going to go to you for any closing comments.
I hope that folks think about this and consider it. I am hopeful that we have a few days this week that maybe we could move forward, but we also have a few weeks this session. So I'm always hopeful that sometimes maybe something can happen, and I would ask for that consideration. And I think, as I indicated in a couple other committees, there may be pieces of these bills that would be doable, that might be helpful to get through that would have a fiscal cost. Obviously, the agency is going to have to implement something there. I would also say on the records retention, there's been some action at the federal level on the pesticide side, not on the fertilizer side, of maybe retrenching and not doing those. So I think these issues are going to be front and center you know, to help provide data for not only the landowner, but the renter and then any subsequent owner. So with that, I would renew my motion that House File 2577 be laid over.
Chair Hansen has renewed his motion that House File 2577 be laid over, and the bill is indeed laid over. We're going to move to another Chair Hansen bill. This is going to be House File 2576. Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 2576 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Chair Hansen has moved House File 2576 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Hansen, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 2576, I think, is a very simple and straightforward bill. You will see letters in your packet from interesting supporters and opponents for this bill. I would just give maybe some folks an indication of my experience with this, that when I was hired at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture back in 1988, we had a program I created called Rinse and Win to encourage an educational program to properly rinse empty pesticide containers. And then I set up a pilot project for recycling empty pesticide containers. And that was 1989 and 1990. Went to Mississippi and watched how they did it, and they came up and watched how we did it, and then that became a model for around the country. So almost 40 years of work that has been done on recycling empty pesticide containers. Now, during that time, pesticide containers have changed dramatically. They were often 2.5 gallon jugs. Now they may be smaller, even, you know, hand sized things, or they may be very big mini bulk containers or larger bulk containers as pesticides have changed. But one thing that hasn't changed is if you burn plastic in open burning, whether it has pesticide residue in or not, you never get to the temperature high enough to destroy the toxins that are in there. In fact, you spread them because the burn heat is not hot enough. And so I think you have testimony or letters in support of doing this. I know there was a question about waste to energy. What we're talking about here is the responsibility of the end user, whether they are an urban, suburban, or agricultural user. The label says to rinse that container, and once you rinse that container, it's solid waste. So this is relating to the open burning, and it's an 18B, so it is with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The A1 amendment I had drafted because we were hopeful that maybe we could get the paraquat ban. I'm not going to move the A1 amendment. I am leaving that out there. I know that the Senate has posted a version of a paraquat ban, and I believe the Department of Agriculture has another version of the paraquat ban. So I have this amendment out there. I would ask members to consider what we could do rather than what we can't do, and would take any questions on 2576.
Before questions, we'll one more time check if there's anyone in the audience who would like to testify for this bill. All right, then we'll move on to questions from committee members for Chair Hansen. Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Hansen, just a kind of more of a background question. You referenced the recycling program that you started, and I've had a chance to sit on a county waste management committee, and so a lot of different recycling. What specifically were the, and maybe there wasn't, maybe there was, but what was the market for those empty containers? Whether it back then or today, what was their end use in the recycling program? I'm just curious. Thank you, Mr.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was a lot of curbs. You know, so it was primarily what they call HDPE, high density polyethylene. If you started mixing the different types of plastic, it limited your use, but the durability and the sunlight impact was mainly curbs. There were some park benches, but it was primarily curbs. And you'd see those at the end painted yellow.
Okay. Representative Lawrence.
Well, of course. And I don't know if you might know that, Mr. Chair and Chair Hansen, What process did they use to eliminate any residue of chemical in that recycling process? You commented that burning doesn't necessarily get hot enough to do that. What in their process would have eliminated any excess of that that it'd be fine to leave in the environment on that level?
Chair Hans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that was why we had the rinsing. And I actually see some of the lobbyists around here who were around at that time. You know, rinsing it, show if you did the triple rinsing and put that rinsate back into the container, then you were getting 99.99% of the product at that time. Now you have different products, you know, that are different packages sometimes now, but that you're using the rinsate for its intended use as the pesticide and you remove that from the plastic container. That's why it wasn't getting recycled. So we would actually bring a portable shredder out and I would sit there with a filter mask on and we would shred the plastic containers. We would drive that on site because it's a lot easier to move dense shred than it is to move empty bottles of air. So we would bring the containers around and shred that, and then that shred would go into Gaylord boxes and would go to these non-human contact things like the curb. And the belief was that those would be bound in the plastic, like on a curb in a parking lot, that they're embedded into that plastic, that the temperature to melt the plastic would bind and reduce any residual at that time. 40 years ago, different world, you know, but that was what was being done.
All right. Representative Gander had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Hansen, it may not be relevant now because you did not move the amendment, but I wonder if we could get a copy of the Ag Department paraquat ban wording, just so we could factor that in against all of the other bits of information we have. Thank
sure.
you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sure we could get that for you. I saw the commissioner move, so would you like to comment? No, okay. Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gander, we can get that. It's what I would just say is it relates to kind of a special exemption under existing authority. The Commissioner of Agriculture has the authority to, if there's an emergency, if there's something with public health currently, so it defines that ability for a special exemption for the continued use of paraquat. It has, I believe, different dates relating to the end of, and I'm not sure on this, so Petter probably has it, but we have a date for stop sale and then stop use. The issue is if you have a stop sale too far out, then you may have hoarding of people buying it. If you have, you don't want to penalize people who have bought it and can't use it. But then I believe it also has some language for clarifying that the waste pesticide program is there currently to help pick up the product that is the end user is choosing not to use anymore. So it's disposed of safely.
So it looks like we have a representative from the department, if you could identify yourself, and then to Representative Gander's question.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair, and good afternoon, members. Chair Hansen had it correct in terms
of... So sorry, could you identify yourself real quick?
Oh, sorry, Peter Chesset, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Thank you.
Chair Hansen has the broad strokes correctly, and I just wanted to clarify that we were asked for and worked with the Senate on this language. This was, I just wanted to make sure you all understood this was not just an agency initiative. This was in response to a request from the Senate. But we'd be happy to have conversations and work with any member in the House or the Senate on this language moving forward.
And is there, I might ask a follow-up question, is there a cost to that Senate version of the bill?
As far as I know, there is still a fiscal note associated with that. That's also part of the conversation is what the overall cost might be, depending on dates and other factors that are being worked on in that language.
Representative Gander, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for allowing me to have that question about the amendment that was not moved. Thank you.
Looks like Vice Chair Harder, you had a question.
Thank you, Chair Smith and Chair Anderson. Okay, I see this bill as another regulation on agriculture. Can you tell me, are there any penalties for non-compliance?
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. They would be, Representative Harder, they'd be the existing penalties under the Pesticide Control Act. So they have administrative penalties, they have civil penalties, and they have criminal penalties. in case, unless something's changed, generally on the administrative penalties, there is a warning, notice of violation. There's usually several steps when there is repeat action. So we're not adding any additional regulatory, it would be the existing Department of Agriculture regulatory suite that they used, and they could highlight the details, but generally it's a, I'm not sure if the correct order, but there'd be like a warning, a notice of violation, and then, you know, if somebody just keeps doing it over and over again, then you may move to a financial penalty, but they have that administrative authority within the department now. This does not add anything.
Vice Chair Harder?
Yes, thank you, Chair Smith and Chair Anderson. My next question has to do about the enforcement of compliance. So I'm trying to think of the entire state of Minnesota and how many farmers may have these containers. So who would enforce the compliance? Would that be the state that would come out to enforce it? Would it come down to the county? And if it is the county, would funds go to the county for enforcement? Thank you.
Chair Hanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Harder, and again, going off of my memory working with the Department of Agriculture, it would be a complaint-driven process. And so when it's complaint-driven, it's not a delegated authority like the feedlot law. 18B rests with the locals do not have that authority with a couple of small exceptions for the big cities. But it is the Department of Ag. It's going to be their inspectors. They would have to respond. They'd have to document and demonstrate that proof.
Vice Chair Harder, do you have a follow-up? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have plenty of time. I'd like to call up Mr. Stamper from the department, if he would step forward. You know, sometimes there's misunderstanding about a federal label and a state label, and maybe Mr. Stamper could explain a little bit about if there's differences in labeling between federal and state, in this case, in terms of container disposal.
Mr. Stamper, if you could identify yourself for the record and then begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you for the question. Typically, when we talk about the regulation of pesticides, we always lead with the label is the law. Every pesticide label that is approved by the EPA is unique, and each of those different labels have specific language that addresses the hazard, the risk, how to safely use these products, what are considerations that need to be had in the handling, the use, the disposal, all of those different things. And as a function of that, there is, to my knowledge, there is not uniform language on pesticide labels saying, do not burn these containers. They will have language that says, like, dispose of in accordance with, like, state and local regulations, because they're trying to draft something that, you know, that can be enforced across the country.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Could you identify yourself for the record so we have that?
Sorry. Joshua Stamper, Division Director of Pesticide and Fertilizer Management.
All right. And Chair Anderson.
He's got one more for you. Don't go away quite yet, Mr. Stamper. thanks, Mr. Chair. A lot of co-ops, and I think it's in conjunction with the department, have collection points or days you can bring your containers in. Could you tell us how widespread that is in Minnesota?
Yes. Mr. Chair, representatives, every ag chem dealer will take back waste pesticide containers from there. This is something that is offered as a service, because typically the industry doesn't want this. They don't want paraquat jugs blowing across fence lines and stuff like that. But those are things that have historically happened. And, you know, I'm not going to say that burning paraquat or burning containers is common, but it happens. And I think that part of this is also an educational message about how do we make sure that everyone understands, like, what are best practices in handling these products, and how do we make sure that we can safely handle them for the future.
Okay. Chair Hanson, did you want to say something?
Just on that, that's 36 years of having container collection programs. So
the idea that they have that ability, you know, so the folks that maybe the small fraction that are burning them, having that law clearly there gives the department the authority. It's not that they don't have another option. They've had it for 36 years.
Chair Anderson, no further questions? All right, it looks like no more questions from committee members. So Chair Hansen, would you like to have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, this is the last committee that the DFL will be chairing. There is one more committee on Wednesday. Often there are extraordinary things that happen at the legislature. But I would, you know, just reach out an open hand to continue these discussions to see what's possible, knowing where our priorities are. And I'm not just speaking for myself, I'm speaking for our committee on the Democratic side. I renew my motion to lay over 2576.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. He has renewed his motion that House File 2576 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. That is our last bill on the calendar for the day. We do have one more committee before third deadline. Chair Anderson, would you like to say anything about Wednesday at all before we get there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, our last meeting on Wednesday, we will have a delete all. And in the meantime, we will be talking with Chair Hansen. And if I could just say one thing about the topic that's holding us up right now, the ban on paraquat. I've talked to a lot of farmers, and I think our committee members have as well. And the one thing that I keep hearing over and over is, if we ban paraquat, what's next? And that's a genuine concern about what could happen down the road. And realizing paraquat is not very widely used anymore, although it is getting more use because of is a burn down for cover crops, which we are encouraging to have more cover crops. But again, it's the I'm not going to say mistrust, but the wondering if we start banning a product, in any product being banned is a serious thing. And the concern is that if we start with this, and you know, I've done a lot of research on this. Bills have been brought up to do this in 13 states. It has not passed in one of them yet. And in two states, in Utah and in West Virginia, I believe, the legislation called for a ban within 1,000 feet of a school. And those bills did not pass. So I think we need to look at this carefully and understand that the use in Minnesota is not very prevalent, maybe a couple hundred thousand acres, and we have 25 million acres of cropland in the state. So we will continue working, and I have not seen the entire Senate language yet. We'll sure take a look at that and try to come to some sort of agreement by Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just directly, so it's in public, Chair Anderson, you know, the paraquat has a danger warning, skull crossbones on the label. Other products like Roundup have a caution label. There are pesticides that are not only hazardous to the environment, but are hazardous to people and take a great deal of care when having that application. You know, you and I have been around long enough where we see movements that come across, you know, and from various sides of the aisle on bills, whatever they may be. I think what we have done, the precedent I would cite is a very old one, and there is a prohibition on the use of 245T in 18B. That was passed in the 1970s by a senator by the name of Tad Jude, who I think is still around, maybe running for things. So we do have precedent for doing a ban, and that was the active ingredient for Agent Orange at the time. And so there wasn't any flurry after that of other bans that went into place. That's probably
I'm not sure on the legislative history, but it's probably 70, 75, 76, 77, somewhere in there, probably 50 years ago. So I think that's the case here, is that, and what the department has provided, what the Senate has, what we could work out, all would be different than whatever a model bill would be. Because I think whenever bills come to Minnesota from whatever they're at, we always can make them better because we've got that skill. And so I hope we can work on this in the next 24, 36, 48 hours and get something that's workable so we can move forward.
All right. We'll see you all in 48 hours. We are adjourned.